The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Keppen family. We wish to thank them. And if this intro music sounds a little different, it is. With the combined April-May edition of Smithsonian, this article is Down the River Roosevelt, a former U.S. president, Brazil's leading explorer, and a deadly voyage in the Amazon, by Larry Rohter, R-O-H-T-E-R, and photographs by Dana Keller. It ranks as one of the greatest feats of exploration in modern times. For 5 months, beginning in mid-December 1913, a team composed at its peak of more than 100 men, Brazilian and American, made its way across South America's great heartland, by land and on rivers, on foot and by horse, mule, truck, and steamboat, and barge, launch and canoe, moving supplies, pack animals, and boats across more than 2,500 miles. Two men of markedly different backgrounds led this extraordinary undertaking. Theodore Roosevelt, only a few years removed from the American presidency, was among the world's most celebrated figures. But throughout his time, he was in the wilderness, mostly deferred to his more experienced Brazilian counterpart, a 48-year-old Brazilian Army colonel named Candido Mariano de Silva Rondon. By any measure, number of expeditions, distances traversed, degree of difficulty, information gathered, Rondon was the greatest explorer of the tropics in recorded history, with a list of accomplishments that eclipses those of better-known figures such as Henry Stanley or Richard Francis Burton. All told, he participated in more than 100 expeditions through Brazil's northern wilderness, surveying his country hitherto unknown territory, mapping its borders, building roads and bridges, founding settlements, and making the initial peaceful contact with dozens of indigenous groups. That Rondon himself was indigenous, an orphan from the state of Mato Grosso, which means dense jungle in Portuguese, who rose to become a marshal of the Brazilian army and spoke 4 European and 6 indigenous languages fluently, made him as comfortable in the cafes of Rio de Janeiro as in the remote corners of the Amazon, able to move easily between the worlds of science and shamanism. Trained as an astronomer and engineer, Rondon was devoted to promoting scientific awareness of the Amazon and its people. A national commission bearing his name published more than 100 scientific papers in disciplines as varied as anthropology, astronomy, biology, botany, ecology, ethnology, geology, herpetology, linguistics, meteorology, mineralogy, ornithology, and zoology. Scientists under Rondon's direction discovered and cataloged scores of new animal, plant, and mineral species. Many of his own scientific papers documented the languages of indigenous people or sought to explain their cultures, cosmology, rites, social structure, and religion. As the founder in 1910 of the Brazilian government's Indian Protection Service, or SBI, which he led for decades afterward, he fought to defend Brazil's native peoples from the ranchers, miners, loggers, and rubber tappers who coveted their land. And he battled the intellectual and political leaders openly, calling for their extermination on scientific grounds. On his own expeditions, Rondon, adhered to a policy of absolute nonviolence in his dealings with tribal groups, many of them previously uncontacted. The SBI's motto was, "Die if you must, but kill never." As early as 1925, Albert Einstein, astonished during a visit to Brazil by the man the press called the pacifist general, nominated Rondon for the Nobel Peace Prize. And when Rondon died, the International Red Cross saluted him as an apostle of nonviolence, whose life and work, like that of Gandhi, constituted a victory for the forces of peace. Rondon's construction of a telegraph line across Brazil's vast, rugged interior, often with the assistance of local indigenous groups, played a central role in the country's transition from a haphazardly organized empire to a modern republic, and it resonates to this day in the country's psyche as a feat of national integration in the way the Transcontinental Railroad was celebrated in the United States. Thus, when Roosevelt, restless for an adventure after an unsuccessful 1912 bid for a third presidential term, made contact with Brazilian authorities about planning an expedition into the uncharted forest, there was no question within Brazil's government who would guide them. In his memoirs, Rondon wrote that he agreed to take Roosevelt through the Amazon only under the condition that the expedition not limit its activities to a series of excursions to hunt for big game, and that serious scientific work be undertaken. Of the five itineraries Rondon proposed, the most ambitious was to descend the Rio da, which he had first encountered during an expedition in 1909 and had learned to explore ever since. No one knew how long the river was, nor the kind of terrain through which it flowed, much less where its waters discharged, hence its provisional name. Roosevelt promptly chose the itinerary that, in Rondon's understated assessment, offered the greatest number of unforeseen difficulties. A descent of the river, Roosevelt wrote, could be made of much scientific value, and with it a substantial addition could be made to geographical knowledge. What Rondon proposed was exploration in its purest, most challenging form. The principal focus would be cartology, with the work to be carried out in terrain utterly unknown to either science or geography. When people at the American Museum of National History urgently wrote Roosevelt in Brazil to warn him of the plan before he set out of the jungle, he responded coolly, "I have already lived and enjoyed as much of life as any 9 other men I know. I have had my full share, and if it is necessary for me to leave my bones in South America, I am quite ready to do so." The river descent itself began on Friday, February 27, 1914, following a grueling 2.5-month trek through the Pantanal, Brazil's vast inland swamp, and across the Mato Grosso Plateau. Breakfast was jerky, hardtack, and coffee. Then the last supplies were loaded onto the canoes. One was small, one was cranky, and 2 were old, waterlogged, and leaky, Roosevelt wrote. The other 3 were good. The smallest, most maneuverable dugout was first in line, carrying Roosevelt's 24-year-old son, Kermit, who had volunteered as lookout, and 2 skilled paddlers named Yoho and Simplico. Kermit had been in Brazil since graduating from Harvard in 1912, working as an engineer, supervising the construction of railroads, trestles, and bridges. Rondon and Lieutenant Yaho Celestio Lira, his second in command, followed in the next boat. Roosevelt, who for security reasons had the expedition's doctor, Jose Antonio Casazera, constantly at his side, was assigned with George Cherry, an American naturalist, to the last and largest of the canoes, a 25-footer weighing more than a ton and given three paddlers. Sandwiched between Rondon's and Roosevelt's canoes were two jury-rigged rafts loaded with cargo, each assigned four boatmen. To the Brazilians, there was nothing unusual about the 16 camaradas, the comrades who paddled and performed the most demanding tasks while descending the river. Like Rondon, they were individuals of mixed European, indigenous, and African ancestry, and also tough backwoodsmen. But the Americans were amazed by the uncomplaining durability of the men, most of whom went about without shoes or shirts, slept in randomly strung hammocks, and worked long hours with little food. They were expert rivermen and men of the forest, skilled veterans in wilderness work, Roosevelt wrote. They were equally at home with pole and paddle, with axe and machete. They were also hard-working, willing, and cheerful, he continued, good men around camp. The first day passed uneventfully as Rondon and Lira began to map the upper reaches of the River of Doubt. Such work would be quick and easy today. But a century ago, without GPS or even meaningful aerial mapping, Rondon and his men did everything manually, by compass and solar observation, using an onerous method known as fixed position sighting. When an appropriate location was found, the spotter jumped ashore, cleared away brush with his machete, and raised a red and white sighting pole until surveyors in a separate boat measured the angle and distance between their position and the sighting rod. Then the spotter would hop back into his canoe, and the process would be repeated at the next stop. Rondon, in the second canoe, meticulously recorded measurements into notebooks custom made in Rio de Janeiro. Lira used a state-of-the-art theodolite, a precision instrument that computes angles in both the horizontal and vertical planes, and Rondon had a compass and a barometer to gauge the river's altitude above sea level. But making frequent stops to calculate position soon grew exhausting. Rondon's field journal indicates that the expedition halted 114 times that first day, barely advancing 7 miles. The River of Doubt was a puzzling and unpredictable stream, twisting and turning in every direction. Rondon's logs from the first afternoon show that at one time or another the river's course flowed in the direction of each of the four cardinal points on the compass. Rondon was pleased, though, at how the trip had begun. "We obtained an abundant supply of game," he wrote. "In addition to game birds, we retrieved honey. It was jubilation when we came across a milk tree, a giant of the forest called that because of the thick white liquid that oozed from any cut made in its bark, and which the camaradas drank avidly." The next day, they made nearly 100 stops to measure location. A routine was shaping up, one that would underscore the often conflicting goals of the American and Brazilian expedition members, generating tensions that would persist throughout the descent. Roosevelt wanted to get down the river as rapidly as possible, reach Manaus, and travel home. He was still a public man with political aspirations, and during the time he had been in South America, he had watched anxiously as the global situation deteriorated, which would soon lead to the outbreak of the First World War. Unable to voice his opinions from afar, he was impatient to leap back into the fray. Kermit was equally restless. He had recently become engaged to Bill Willard, the Virginia-bred daughter of U.S. Ambassador to Spain, and was obsessed with reuniting with her. His diary was filled with musings about her and dreams about their future together, and he carried her letters to him in a pouch around his neck so they would not be lost. Rondon, by contrast, had waited nearly 5 years to return to the river he had discovered, and he intended to exploit this opportunity to explore it. He had forewarned Roosevelt himself this would not be a safari, but a bona fide scientific expedition, and he expected every member to do his part. The men faced their first big challenge in the afternoon of March 2. The river suddenly accelerated, and they found themselves bouncing through rapids with water foaming angrily ahead. The paddlers quickly pulled off to the right bank, secured the canoes, and set up camp, while a scouting party hacked their way through the brush to reconnoiter. What they discovered gave everyone pause. For half a mile, the river bounded downward through a series of boiling rapids, which were broken by a pair of waterfalls 6 feet high. Then it narrowed dramatically and surged through a jagged sandstone gorge. It seemed extraordinary, almost impossible, Roosevelt wrote, that so broad a river could, in so short a space of time, contract its dimensions to the width of the strangled channel through which it now poured its entire volume. It took an entire day to tote food crates, tents, duffel bags, and scientific equipment to a new campsite below the rapids. Rondon exempted from the task one ailing paddler, and Kermit, who had developed a painful case of boils on his thighs, but both of the expedition's commanders joined the others in transporting the gear. Early the next morning, Lyra and a party of camaradas headed into the forest with axes and machetes to fell dozens of trees and cut their trunks around into rounded logs. They placed these along a portage trail evidently used by local Indians, thereby creating a skidway along which they could drag the canoes. Meanwhile, another team heaved the empty dugouts from the river bank to be pulled along the skidway one by one. This was backbreaking work, magnified in difficulty by the insects that swarmed, bit, and stung. A pair of camaradas was stationed in front of each of the canoes, each connected to the boat by a drag rope fastened around his torso. A third stood behind with a pole, which he used to guide the canoe as it clumsily slid down the uneven log path. Several dugouts slammed into sandstone ledges to the left. At least one was split badly. Still another made it all the way down the trail, only to slip free of the ropes and, as it was lowered back into the water, sink to the bottom. It was retrieved with strenuous effort by the exhausted camaradas. The expedition resumed its journey at midday on March 5. The next day, though, the explorers encountered more rapids and were forced to steer to the river bank. A scouting party discovered that some 400 yards downstream, the river smashed into a line of giant boulders, impeding all passage, followed by at least a mile of rapids and a pair of waterfalls about 100 yards apart. Another portage awaited, even longer and more difficult than the first. We had no idea how much time the trip would take, Roosevelt would write. We had entered a land of unknown possibilities. On March 15, as the first two canoes rounded a bend in the river, the stream widened, dividing into two sets of roiling rapids, separated by an island. Rondon, sensing trouble, ordered his dugout to pull to the side and called to Kermit's canoe to do the same. but Kermit either did not hear Rondon or chose to ignore his command. The lead canoe plunged forward, heading directly for the island. Kermit and his boatman, Yoho Aplico, progressed barely a dozen yards when their canoe was sucked into a powerful downdraft, which spun the craft around. The canoe reached the end of the rapids upright, only to be seized by another whirlpool, which hurled it back to midstream, overturning it. Now all three men, tossed into the foaming water, were battling for their lives. Yoho grabbed for the tow line and swam for shore, but could not maintain his hold on the rope. Kermit managed to climb onto the keel of the overturned canoe and ride it, like a bull at a rodeo, through a set of rapids before being thrown off. Desperate and exhausted, his waterlogged clothing weighing him down, he swam for shore, where he could only cling to a branch until he had recovered his breath. Kermit was back on land, walking to find the others, when Rondon and Lyra encountered him on the trail. "Well, you've had quite a splendid bath, eh?" Rondon said to the younger Roosevelt. There is no way to know if his tone was sarcastic, in reproach to what he perceived as Kermit's youthful heedlessness, or whether he was making sympathetic joke, relieved that the son of his eminent guest had not perished. But where were Yoho and Simplico? Yoho showed up not long after, having swum back across the river. But there was no sign of Simplico. In addition, the canoe was lost, along with the supplies in it. Devastated, Kermit set out on his own to search for Simplicio. He walked for several miles, but recovered only one paddle and a single food tin. Simplicio's body was never found. In his diary, Kermit was guarded by his boatman's death, writing only, "Simplicio was drowned." For his part, Roosevelt portrayed the disaster as simply an accident of fate. In a private conversation with Rondon through Yoho, said that Kermit had heard Rondon's command to stop, but decided to see if they could run the rapids to the island's right, and ordered the boatmen ahead. With no body to bury, Rondon had the men erect a memorial cross, reading, "Here perished the unfortunate Simplicio, at the edge of the rapids." He also named the falls in Simplicio's honor, and they appear as such on Brazilian maps even today. In every account of the Roosevelt-Rondon scientific expedition over the past century, Brazilian or American, Simplicio has always been identified merely by his first name, or as poor Simplicio. But in Rondon's records and Simplicio's complete name, Antonio Simplicio da Silva. Another exhausting portage began amid sheets of rain, while the camaradas felled trees for a skidway, cleared brush, and hauled the canoes from the river. Rondon and his favorite dog Lobo headed down a jungle path to do reconnaissance, and with any luck, shoot a game bird or a monkey for meat. But half a mile down from camp, a peculiar howling echoed through the forest, almost, but not exactly, like that of a spider monkey, the largest simian in the jungle and an excellent source of meat. Lobo instinctively bounded ahead as Rondon peered into the canopy, his rifle at the ready. Within seconds, though, he heard his dog yelping, first in surprise, then in pain. He advanced cautiously, registering unwelcome human sounds, short exclamations, energetic and repeated in a kind of chorus with a certain cadence that he had heard before only when indigenous war parties were ready to commence the attack. He fired a single shot, warning shot, in the air. overcoming my initial impulse to run and defend Lobo, then hurried back to camp. Rondon's immediate concern was an ambush. He dispatched Cherry to warn the camaradas upstream, asked Roosevelt to mount guard at the end of the portage, and with Kermit, Lyra, and the indigenous scout Antonio Parisi accompanying him, returned to the trail in search of Lobo. When they reached the dog, it was already dead, pierced by a pair of poison-tinged arrows whose design was unfamiliar to Rondon and Parisi. Before returning to the site of the ambush, Rondon had grabbed several axe heads and stuffed his pockets with colored beads, presents for what he assumed was a hunting party frightened by his approach. He buried Lobo next to a basket full of animal entrails the Indians had brought as bait, probably for fishing, but abandoned as they fled. Around Lobo's grave, Rondon arrayed his gifts to signal to the indigenous people, likely members of the people known as the Cinta Larga, whose relations with the outside world continued to be tense and even violent into the 21st century, that his intentions remained peaceful. Rondon had been lucky, and he knew it. I thought, mourning, fully contemplating my dead companion, that perhaps he had given his life for mine. The explorers were now down to four canoes, simply not enough to carry 21 men and their equipment. To continue, the canoes would have to be lashed together to form a pair of rafts, each with three paddlers and one principal aboard, and loaded with as much equipment as they could support. The remaining equipment would have to be discarded, and the rest of the men would hack their way along overgrown riverbanks until they reached a new campsite, alert to any sign of an Indian attack. And we've run out of time for today's exciting episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support from the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their continued support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.